Good evening. I'm Kathy. I'm an incredibly attractive alcoholic with a keen fashion sense. I tell you that because you might not notice if I didn't. Okay, I'm supposed to thank people. I'd like to thank Denise. I'd like to thank Larry for working construction. I'd like to thank my husband, who likes me a lot. He does. I'd like to thank Eric for chairing. I'd like to thank Sean for showing me around Vancouver. I do not want to thank Jack for speaking before me. How would you like to follow that? I am not a circuit speaker. Okay, who in here has heard me before? Raise your hand. See? So hopefully you have no expectations. If you're buying the whole album, I apologize now. You can always make your sponsees listen to my tape. Think about it. Okay, 10:14. That only gave me 2 hours and 43 minutes, right? Okay. You're welcome to leave. You're welcome to go pee. You're welcome to smoke. You're welcome to sleep. You know, this is your conference. You paid to come here. They paid me. So we're good now. Okay. By the grace of a God I certainly didn't believe in when I got here and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship and a bazillion meetings, I have not had to take a drink since I walked into my first meeting, which is August 12, 1994, and for that I'm very grateful. For those of y'all who are mathematically challenged, that is 73 years of continuous sobriety. I didn't want to stand up to make the other people feel bad. For those of you who can do math, you know that's 13 years. I am your token Appalachian American up here. You'll notice there's no one else from there. I'm also somewhat Southern. I'm also really short, but I'm very good looking, so it kind of makes up for the rest of it. I hope to maybe get serious at some point, but I can't promise that I will. I'm supposed to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and I'm going to try to do that in 2 hours and 43 minutes. But all kidding aside, I have a little, can you see me in the back? Okay. I've never spoken for a group this small before. Anyway. I found this, my husband and I travel a lot, and we were in Colorado, I think Mancos, Colorado, and they had some used books in this store, and I found a daily reflection, and inside it was this little prayer that had been cut out of a box 459, which does not make it conference approved, but it is published by the General Service Office. So for those of y'all who would like to listen to this prayer, you can, and for those of y'all who don't, you can text someone on your cell phone. Prayer for today. God, bless all the alcoholics, wherever they may be. Bless those unfortunates who are in most need of sobriety. Look upon them with compassion and mercy and lead them on to this wonderful fellowship that only through you it may help them as it has helped me and thousands and millions of others. Bless those who are sober today. Give grace to those who are on the way. But God, please show compassion and mercy to those who may never come. Okay, let's get started about me. I was born in a small town in Tennessee. That's where this accent comes from. I am a West Virginian by choice, a Tennessean by birth. I'm East Tennessean. We really are hillbillies. I've spent my whole life looking at dirt. Really kind of tired of it. West Virginia is the size of Texas if you flattened us out. There was nothing particularly remarkable about my childhood. I'm 56 years old. I was born in 1952, a small mill town in Tennessee. My father was an electrician, worked at Oak Ridge, where they built the bomb. He died when I was about 7, I think. This did not really make me an alcoholic. It just happened to be the way it was. Our big book, and Jack touched on a little bit, says that, you know, the bottom was but a symptom of our disease, and selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of it. I'm going to give you a couple of examples of me. to show you that although I am an alcoholic and I like to drink till I fell down, the root of my disease is selfishness and self-centeredness. I can never successfully drink, but if I don't get out of self, I'm in big trouble. When we were about two or three, my family raised dachshunds. And they let us, my brother and I each got our first dog, and they let us name it. I named my dog Kathy. I'm three. I named my dog Kathy. Okay, let's bump on up a few years to I'm in elementary school, and my brother has a paper route, but he also goes to Boy Scout camp for two weeks in the summer. And during those 2 weeks, I carry his paper, and I get to keep all the money I collect. It was an afternoon paper, but I'm not just good looking, I'm really smart. And it dawned on me that at 6 o'clock on Saturday morning, everyone is home. So, on the 2 weeks that I carried my brother's paper, at 6 o'clock in the morning, I would be banging on the doors to collect delinquent accounts. They always showed me the money. Sometimes they canceled their paper then and there, but I always got the money. Okay, I'm in elementary school. I'm not drinking a lot yet. Okay? This is me. Let's bump on up a few more years to high school. And in high school, I was not that lonely outsider. I was very popular. I didn't even put out, and I was very popular. That soon changed. Well, anyway, my mother worked for Commercial Credit Corporation, and they had a scholarship program. And my mother being a secretary, you know, we weren't rolling in the big bucks. So in order to get a scholarship, you had to take an SAT test. Well, not only am I really good looking, I'm smart, and I do well on tests because I don't get nervous. So I take the test. As it turns out, you can send your scores to three different schools if you want to, or for free it was back then. So I decided to have my score sent to Notre Dame. Not that unusual, except it was not co-ed then. But I thought, a date, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, homecoming queen, head cheerleader, head majorette, I don't twirl, details, sweetheart of every fraternity, I was not accepted. Okay, I'm still not drinking. Insanity, that's me. I drank a little in high school. It was a dry county in Tennessee. That meant you couldn't buy alcohol there except at the bootleggers. I've never been very tall. I could never pass for older till I got older. So I didn't drink a lot in high school. What I did notice that when we could get a hold of it, which wasn't that often, I did not drink like my little girlfriends. This was the 70s. You know, we had all that hair, all that makeup. And these girls would go and have like one drink, and then they would get silly, and then they would get really drunk, and then they would puke. They could never puke without getting their hair in it. And then after, and then after they puked and got their hair in it, then they would cry. And then their mascara would like, and they're in the bathroom, and they could not hit the toilet. And then their boyfriend would come and get you to go sit with her because she's all crying and upset. And I really did not like drinking with women. I mean, that's a real downer when you have to do that. I like drinking with men. Y'all were much better about the puking. And a lot of you did not wear mascara then, so there was that whole crying issue too. There's nothing wrong with wearing mascara. I'm so naturally beautiful, I don't need it. Well, actually, the truth is I'm too lazy. I'll put it on. It takes 3 days to get it off, and it does not look that good on the second day. So that's why I don't wear makeup. Well, not only am I really pretty and good-looking and smart, I got a full academic scholarship to college. And I tell you that because I like to brag. So off to college, 1970. I went to the University of Tennessee. Go Vols, beat Bama. And there, the drinking age was still 21, and I was 19, I think. And out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, there's this going to be a drug log. I did a whole lot of drugs, but they never fit like alcohol. I tried them. I got tired of them. I moved on. The advantage of drugs were you didn't have to have an ID. But then they lowered the drinking age. And I went to discover what liquor by the drink was all about. and I loved it. I don't know if they have them here. The second Ruby Tuesday's open in Knoxville, and I think I'm responsible for the continuation of that chain. I love drinking. I love drunk. I loved really drunk. I loved extra drunk. I love falling down drunk. That was always the level I went for, was horizontal. With or without someone, didn't really matter. Horizontal. That's what I went for. And for years, I didn't even have hangovers. I mean, I could drink and drink and drink and drink and drink and drink and drink, and I did. But what I discovered even then, and this was a hard thing, occasionally I could actually embarrass myself. I'm not even going to go into that from the podium, what it would take, but it could happen. And when I would do that, then I would stop. I never stopped drinking forever. I just always stopped drinking for a while. I had no trouble putting it down, move on, got along with my life. All my friends drank. I had the Hornet, an AMC Hornet. I was the driver. It had four doors and totally invisible to police. So I would still drive them around, and it would be okay. And then after whatever length of time I thought had gone by, I would pick it up again. What I learned was, long before I got here, that it didn't take me very long to get back to where I was. I knew it was either drinking or non-drinking. Moderation was really not, you know, one of my catchphrases. So here I am, I'm in college, I'm drinking. And then I discovered that classes really interfered with your drinking. And I learned important things like, if you're not going to go to class, don't buy the books. That's a waste of a lot of good drinking money. It was the 70s, and some teachers gave random grades. So if you didn't drop out, you could get credit. So I have credits for courses I never went to, but they gave them to me anyway. College almost killed me. Eventually, they took away that scholarship. Funny little rules about passing some classes. And I finally got ready to graduate after maybe 6 years, and then they had this unknown rule that you had to have a 2-point average to graduate. So I had to go and tell a whole bunch of lies to get these incompletes taken off my thing so I could finally graduate. And I had one course left, and you had to write a paper, and I didn't like to write a paper, so I paid somebody to write the paper, only they had a little alcohol problem, they didn't get the paper written. And so I left college with an incomplete, and it only took me 11 years to get it. Actually, someone wrote the paper for me, so I guess that's kind of a lie, too. But anyway, so I get out of college, and, you know, I've spent all their money and a lot of my time. And my first job out of college, I was a janitor, and there's nothing wrong with that. I was pretty good at it. And then I was a gopher in office, and then I became a waitress, which is a very good job to have if you're a drinker. And I did that, and my major, political science. We know there's a lot you can do with that. I was going to go to law school, no offense, Jack, but it was 1970-ish, and tie-dyed, bell-bottoms, barefoot, and I'm looking around these poli-sci classes, and at that time, there were only 3 poli-sci majors at the University of Tennessee, and they wore suits. I mean, they were suits, briefcases, suits, and I looked around and said, I don't belong here. These are not my people. So I didn't ever become a lawyer. I don't really regret that. No offense, Jack. Anyway, so la 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 la. I'm waiting tables, and I have this friend whose mother's a lobster fisherman in the Keys, and she hurts her back. So we go down to the Keys to lobster fish, which means you pull the traps out of the water. Well, while I'm down there, I meet a guy. Any of you girls know about guys? I know 2 things. I know food, and I know men. What was it they used to say about the 70s? We were trying to find ourselves. Flip over the closest guy, you're fine to me, you know. I have tried to work up some shame about that, and I'm just not having any luck with it. I had one moral. I stayed away from married men. That's a very good moral because sometimes wives have guns. So I made a lot of men happy. So when I was doing my 4th step on sexual inventory, there were not a lot of guys I needed to apologize to, but there are a lot of women I owe a lot of amends to because I lied to those guys. I told them they were good. Yeah, I did. It's the only way you can get them off, okay? You women know. So I'm sleeping my way to the bottom. And I meet this really, really nice guy from Chicago, Illinois, and he was one of these back-to-the-landers of the 70s. And he was a suburban Chicago boy who had moved to West Virginia. Yes, John Denver wrote that psalm. Sadly, he was looking at Virginia when he wrote it. But you could get really cheap land, and a lot of people moved there. He got 53 acres for $1,500. Yeah. And so he invited me to come to visit. That's a very dangerous thing to do. I will show up with three suitcases and move in. I know Denise and Larry are now worried because I showed up their house with five suitcases, but one of them was my husband's. So I move out in the woods, and we don't have gas or electricity or running water, although I like to joke and say we did have running water because I would holler at Paul and he would run go get it. And without realizing it, I guess that was a geographical change. Paul did not drink. He did not do any drugs. He did not eat meat. And for a wild, crazy night, he'd smoke a tobacco cigarette. Really nice guy. Kind of boring. But really nice. He really was a nice guy. And so I didn't drink a whole lot in that time. And we ate organic food and a lot of cheese and farted a lot. And, you know, grains will do that to you. We raised an organic garden. I learned a lot about nutrition. I learned how not to work, which is really kind of a good thing sometimes. And so, you know, that's how it went. But at some point, Paul got really tired of me. I can't imagine why. I'm a little bit bossy and controlling and annoying and aggravating, and I give constant details and everything. So anyway, Paul wanted me to leave, but I didn't want to leave because I liked it there. And so he said he was going to call the sheriff and have the sheriff come and take me away. Because that's what you do when you want him to leave in case any of y'all need someone to leave. The sheriff can come and take him away if the property's in their name. But Paul was actually growing a marijuana crop for money. And I said if the sheriff came, I would go sit by the pot plant. And so he didn't call the sheriff, but someone stole the pot plant. And I accused him of pulling it up just so he could get rid of me. But I said, okay, I finally agreed to leave, but I said, I'm going to need a job. And at this time, the Carpenters Local in West Virginia was taking applications for their apprenticeship program. Well, remember, pretty, smart, good at test taking. And at the time, their test was all mathematics. Well, I'd had calculus in college. I could do a little plain geometry. So I took this test, and I scored 3rd out of 300. Once again, I tell you that because I like to brag. And then we had to do an interview. Well, at the time, I'm 50 pounds less, and they're looking at me, and they've never had a woman in their union before, and they're looking down at me, and I had no idea what carpenters did. And they said, they were wondering, okay, I'm a woman, I'm college educated, why do I want to get in their union? And they said, why do you want to get in the union? And I went, to build America. Can't argue with that. Actually, they let me in because they thought I was a communist infiltrator there to break the union. I swear. So they took me in, and I thought, cool, I'll learn how to build a house and make furniture. I'm a bridge carpenter. I know concrete. I know more about concrete than I ever wanted to know. I also know scaffolding. That's how I met Larry, Denise's husband. And so that's what I did, and I loved it. Men, as far as the eye could see, you know, I love men. There was no dress code. I did not have to wear makeup. I did not have to do my hair. And I got paid to do physical labor, which is a very good thing for me because I do not recreationally sweat. So I'm in shape. I'm eating like a high school football player. It was wonderful. And I don't know if you know, but there have been construction workers who have drunk. It's somewhat rare, but not altogether rare. So at this time, they were very down on drugs, but by this time, I wasn't doing any drugs, and so drinking was cool. And I loved it. But the bestest thing about it was you got layoff time, and you got to get a check, which is really good times to drink. The unemployment comes in, you get the check. So this was good. So I did this, and at times when work got really slow, then I would go back to waitressing. Well, about this time, Harvard came out with a study that said, if you're white, college educated, never been married, don't have children, don't buy Brides Magazine. Not going to happen. I had, I think, a 0.03% chance of getting married. Unluckily for my husband, I beat the odds. I like to joke and say I came into Alcoholics Anonymous because my husband had a very serious problem with alcohol, and he did. It was me. We started dating, and the very first year we dated, he did not like me. I put out. He wasn't stupid. It's just the way it was. I thought he was aloof. See, I have such an ego that I cannot detect dislike. I just thought he was aloof. Well, over time, I grew on him. And not everybody rushes into relationships. We dated 3 years before he told me he loved me. And we dated 6 years before I finally said, "Do you think we're ever going to get married?" And he said, "Yeah, someday." And I said, "Next year, I want health insurance." And he said, "Okay." And that was our romantic marriage proposal. That's how we did it. So we got married in 1990, and I think I just quit trying. I don't know about any of you ladies that have managed to hold it together for as long as you did. I've been fully self-supporting through my own contributions, but I just quit trying. I mean, I'd still work when I had a job, but I could no longer control my drinking. You know, it just got worse and worse and worse. And what should have been the happiest time of my life? I was having a job I liked. I had a wonderful man for a husband. I'm married into a whole family of spiritual giants. You know, but alcoholism is a disease, and for me it didn't matter what was going on in my life. And I became one of those wonderful stay-at-home drunk women. You know, I don't have any big giant stories. I never stole a train, robbed a bank. I've never been to jail. I've never even had a speeding ticket. I've never been pulled over. You know, I'm just one of those alcoholic women that ends up staying home in this week's outfit, making long-distance phone calls. You know? It's hard to get help, you know, you just don't bring a lot of attention to yourself. And even better, I'm an afternoon drinker. I'm not a night drinker. I'm passed out by 9. I'm not calling you at 2, I'm calling you at 7, you'll talk to me. You know, my friends appreciated that. As a matter of fact, obviously I can be very drunk and don't sound it, because after I got sober and quit calling people, they started calling me wondering what was wrong. And I said, "I'm not drunk anymore." And they said, "Were you drunk?" It's like, "Yeah." So I'm drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking. And my husband, who is not an Al-Anon, if you read his name tag, it says handsome husband. He has the amazing ability to completely ignore me. It's a gift. He's needed it more than once. And he in no way tried to any way control my drinking. He just kept on with his life. Oh, I will have to say that he worked on the coal barges. So he was in 3 weeks, out 3 weeks. So by the time it was time to go back to work, he was ready to go to work, you know. And when he came home, he was glad to see me, but in 3 weeks, he was ready to go back to work. And you know that loneliness that hits us, that big old hole with the cold wind blowing through? Well, I noticed my own behavior, that when it got time for him to go back, my behavior would get worse and worse, and I would try to control it, and I couldn't. And I'd rag on him and rag on him and rag on him. And he could take it a really long time. In all the many years we've been together, he raised his voice to me one time. It was the college playoffs. I got between him and the TV because he was not paying enough attention to me. And he just sort of said, well, I don't know about any of y'all, but I would start supper sometimes to get really tired and have to lay down before I finish supper. So I'd lay down. And then he finished supper at halftime, and I wanted a plate of food, and he wasn't doing it fast enough, and so I got between him and the TV, and he raised his voice to me. Upset my delicate alcoholic feelings. But he still never said anything about my drinking. One thing is, I drank about a lot of his friends. He tried to keep up with my drinking very, very, very hard. And I have noticed that my husband is not an alcoholic. He does drink today, just not very much. I do not understand how he drinks. He will have a drink. A drink. And sometimes he doesn't finish it. He will be home on a Sunday, going to watch sports all day long, not leave the house, not drive anywhere, and he'll drink water. I don't get it. I'll never understand it. It's just, that's alcohol abuse, I think. Anyway, so I'm getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. But I have this friend in Knoxville, Tennessee, been my friend since the 70s. She and I love to drink together. She was worse than me because she drank box wine mixed with club soda. Now that's an alcoholic. I would go down with her and we'd have weekend drink-a-thons, or we would, you ever drunk on the phone with people? That's fun. We'd call each other up, how our mothers love somebody else best, have big wine-a-thons. But I'd been calling Doris, and I hadn't been reaching her on the phone, just getting her machine. But one day I reached her, and she said she'd been 45 days without a drink. Whoa, I wasn't putting 45 days together anymore, let me tell you, boys and girls. 2 or 3 days was about the best I could do. Well, we chatted, and then I didn't reach her again for about 45 more days. And she had not had a drink in 90 days. And I said, how'd you do it? She said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, I probably ought to go to those meetings. She said, I bet they have them in your area. And thanks to public information, every Sunday the schedule was being printed in our newspaper. And I would read that. And I would read that. And I knew two things about Alcoholics Anonymous. One, once you join, you never drank again as long as you lived. And the other one was step 9. Those were the two things I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I said, they do have meetings here. And I said, I probably ought to go to them. And she said, if I come up and take you to a meeting, will you go? And I said, yeah. I didn't ponder. I didn't think. I didn't think why. I just said, yeah. It's kind of been, I found out that some of the best choices of my life I probably didn't make. Somebody else made them. So she said, well, I'll check my schedule and I'll call you back. So she called back on a Thursday and she said, I'll be there tomorrow on Friday. Call and see where the meetings are. So, unlike Jack, since I knew that this was going to be my very last day of drinking because I was joining Alcoholics Anonymous and I can never drink again as long as I lived, I went right to the store. I bought a fifth of Tanqueray, 2 bottles of tonic, and 3 limes. I'm proud about Tanqueray and tonic as my last drink. I hope. So I proceeded to drink what I hope is my last drunk, my last blackout, my last pass out. Sometime during the night, I did call the hotline. They gave me the schedule. Has anyone else ever had trouble writing when you're drunk? I invented a shorthand on the spot that was just a series of marks that I knew would make sense the next morning. I was wrong. I promptly admitted it. Doris got there about 2 o'clock. We're old friends. She didn't talk about the steps or the traditions or God or sponsor or higher power. You know, we just visited. We went and got something to eat. And she said, where's the meeting? I go, I don't know. I can't read my handwriting. Well, you know, this program is about finding a power greater than yourself that can solve your problems. And I will tell you that through my whole life, I had never, ever thought much about God. I come from an interesting religious background. My father was Roman Catholic and my mother was Tennessee Church of Christ. That's a very interesting combination. Actually, it's a very good combination. I have no prejudice about anything. After my father died, my mother gave my brother and I the option of whether we wanted to go to catechism. We opted out. I don't know anything about the Catholic dogma. There were no mean nuns in my story. Town was too small for Catholic school. We got 2 weeks of, well, I know it's not vacation Bible school, but I can't remember what they called it, you know. And we learned songs and got to color. I thought it was pretty cool. But God was this, maybe it was there, maybe it wasn't, didn't really have anything to do with me, you know. I have to say there have been times of panic in my life where I have said some prayers, but I didn't necessarily believe they were going anywhere. As Catholic, you know, we learn all those great prayers, Hail Marys. And on those nights when I would lay in bed and I could not sleep and my mind would race, I would lay in bed and say Hail Marys, not because I really believed it would have any purpose, because I thought maybe it would calm my mind enough to go to sleep. Maybe I prayed myself into Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know. But I would say those and say those and say those and say those. So Doris shows up, and I have to remember, she drove 5 hours to take me to my first meeting. And when I'm too tired, or I'm too recovered, or I don't want to go, or gas costs $4 a gallon, I need to remember that the person that took me to my first meeting drove 5 hours one way to take me. And she could have been... She probably could have done something else that weekend. She probably could have had plans. She probably could have done anything. Because, you know, sometimes what I found is recovery is not always convenient. You know, and it's those inconvenient times where I get the rewards from doing it. So we go to eat, so we call, and like I said, I certainly didn't ever pray for myself or anybody else. As a matter of fact, this family of spiritual giants that I'm married into, friends of mine were having, they were having twins, and they'd had in vitro, well, they didn't know yet, they'd had in vitro, and they'd implanted six, and so I called my mother-in-law. I used to call my mother-in-law and ask her to pray for people. I'm not praying, but, you know, I thought if there was a God, he'd listen to her. And so I said, could you, yeah, well, really, and he does. And I said, could you ask God to give them twins? She goes, oh, no, I can't do that. She said, but I'll ask God to give them the strength, courage, and wisdom to deal with what comes. So anyway, so Doris says, when's the meeting? I'm going, I don't know. So I call, and it's at 8 o'clock. Right now it's about 10 till 7. And I guess it was some sort of a prayer, which was, please let the meeting be at 7. It'll be too late. We won't go, and I can go tomorrow. Well, that one didn't get answered. The meeting was at 8. It was a little over a mile from our house. I think we left at 7:15, got there at 7:20. And I go in, and Doris has the 90-day glow. You know, her feet are not touching the floor. Everything is beautiful. You know? And I'm like, and Doris is looking around, and this is a clubhouse. We know how those are. There were dry riders there. No offense, guys. I was not a biker babe. I was a firm bar kind of drinker. And she's looking around going, looks like a nice group of people. And I thought, Lord, this girl drank way too long. So we go on in the room where nobody's sitting down yet, and it's Friday night. It's a big book study. They have the table set up with the chairs, but they also have the chairs around the room. Well, I thought the chairs were for the important people. I mean, the ones that are around the table, which, of course, you know I was there the next Friday. But I sat in the back, and I'm sitting there, and Doris. And I start reading those steps on the wall, because I'll read anything put in front of me, even if it's in a foreign language. I can't understand it, but I'll still read it. And I look at that first step, and it said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. And I went, bingo, that's what I am. I don't believe Bill could have picked a better word than powerless. It's exactly what I am. The bad part is, step one is two parts. The unmanageability of my life took me 18 months not drinking and wanting to drive my car into a bridge before I finally got on my knees and surrendered. I didn't believe in God, hadn't tried to believe in God, wasn't worrying about it, but I got on my knees and said, I can't do this anymore. You're going to have to do this. And I got up from that, and I think step one was worked, and step two was came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, and for me that was Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that if I finally did what they told me to do, that I would be better. Step three, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. I just turned my will and my life over to the rest of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if I turned my life over in step three, I wouldn't need the other nine. Thank you very much. I don't know how to turn my life over. I don't know how to take control and wreck it, but I don't know how to turn it over. So I did that four-step inventory, and what I'd like to throw in here is I have done some other inventory since then. I know there are those people that believe you do it one time. My literature tells me this is but the beginning of a lifetime practice. If one's enough for you, fine, but I am not that good yet. What I'm happy to report is, you know, that first one was resentments, fears, sexual inventory. In that, it's not all about all the puny people I slept with or what I did. It's how I treated those people with whom I have a romantic involvement. And it was for the very first time I realized when I was in a relationship, somebody else was there. It was all about me. You know? I would do for you because I wanted you to love me. You know, I didn't care about you really, but as long as you love me, it's all about me. It's all about me. Love me. And so there was the sexual inventory and harms done others. This last inventory I've done, what I can tell you is age will really shorten that sexual inventory. Matter of fact, I didn't have to waste any pen and paper at all. It's over. You older women and some of you men will understand. You know, that's really good. You know, I don't have to, I'm not harming others that way anymore. Okay. Step five, my favorite topic. This was not a hard one for me at all. I've never had a secret. I will not tell your secrets. I'm too busy talking about mine. By this time, I had moved to, I was in another area working on a job, and I met the lady who was to become my sponsor and take me through those steps, and she did a great job. And on step six, by this time, I actually had some character defects. I know some of y'all got here perfect like I did. I thought they were personality quirks. I thought manipulation was a wonderful thing. It's not, but you can still use it sometimes if you have to. Guilt tripping. I mean, how fun is that? Well, anyway, I made a list of my character defects, and for me, self-righteousness tops the list. There are a lot of people who always felt less than. I have always felt better than. I'm sure psychiatrists are just tearing this apart right now, thinking, oh, you felt so bad, that's why you felt so good. I don't know. I've mostly always felt sorry for people who weren't me. Okay, low self-esteem got me in this fellowship. I started having some of those days, and I don't know how you people have lived with it your whole life. I mean, I'm serious. But I also tell you, self-righteousness, it's real lonely at the top. You're always disappointing me. You're never living up to my expectations. It's hard, and it's better, but it's not gone. So I made those lists, and then she had me write about what it was like with them and what it would be like without them. And you know what they do is they cut me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. They make me completely incapable of connecting with you. Well, I'm not really believing in God yet or anything now, but they told me to pray. Thank God it's free, because I'm really cheap. So I started praying, and surprise, surprise, my first prayers were about resentments. And then I went on to start praying for people maybe who I liked or who I didn't like or who had some health issues or emotional issues. So I'd pray for them. So I'm kind of doing this thing, la, 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 la. And then step 8, and I make those lists of all people I had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Well, when you're a people pleaser and you sleep with people on the first date, that list is kind of short. But what I discovered, mine were sins of omission, not commission. You know, I'd never been a very good, I was a terrible sister. I have a brother. Okay, I tolerate him now. I'm really glad he lives in another state. I became a not very good daughter, and I was a terrible wife. Sometimes I was a good friend, and I was a good friend when it was convenient, and only then. So when it came to my step 9, what I tried to do was be better in those areas. I was able to redevelop a relationship with my mother. We were never buddy-buddy, talking on the phone every day, but we were better. My mother lived in southern Florida. I was really grateful. I'll just be straight up with you. I was able to go down, and I could spend 3 days with her and not say something ugly, you know? And that's as good as it got, but that was good enough. That was better than it was. I was able to thank my brother for taking care of my mom. He lived down there with her, kind of forgot to pay his mortgage for 3 years, and they repossessed his house. Funny little mortgage rule. And he was never going to. My brother has his own issues. My mother loved my brother best. My husband will vouch for that. But you know what? It became okay. That was my greatest resentment my whole life, and it became okay because I realized that the relationship my mother had with my brother was their business and not mine. My mother did love me. She just liked him better, and that was okay. So I did my step 9s, and one of the ways I would make a step 9 to my mother was she loved smoked cigarettes, tobacco. And my brother hated smoking, so I would send my mother 3 cigarettes in a letter at a time. She'd suck the first 2 down and enjoy the last one, and it got her up walking to the mailbox every day. Little things that you do. And I would call her weekly and listen to everything my brother's kids had eaten for the whole week, you know. Better than what it was. Okay, now we're at step 10. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I didn't really have to do that step because I've never been wrong. Moved right on. I do remember the day I was wrong, and I stayed wrong the whole day. Because the way my mind worked, if I did something to you in a millisecond, it was your fault, and you owed me an apology. But I remember the day in recovery when I was wrong, and I stayed wrong. I didn't take your inventory. I just realized I was wrong. Now, step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. Well, I started praying. I was praying pretty regularly by this time, but I wasn't meditating, but I was going to a step study. And every time we'd roll back around to step 11, it's like, I'm going to start meditating. You know, not because I thought I would grow spiritually so I could brag about it. There are no bad reasons for doing any of these steps. So I heard a speaker once at the platform said he started with 3 minutes. It's like, I can do that. So So I started meditating 3 minutes, bumped up to six, now it's 10 minutes. That's as good as it's getting, but it's good enough. I'd love to stand up here and tell you that I pray and meditate every day, and that would be a big old lie. I'm easily distracted. You get me off my schedule, it's hard for me to do it. I just came back from almost a 2-week vacation, and I was trying to catch up on my reading, and I think the last time I read was maybe May 14th. You know, I'm caught up today, so you can tell I'm a spiritual giant today. And what I also have to say is by this time, I'm finally starting to believe in something. Can't describe it, don't understand it, but I believe in something. I'm starting to feel something there. Not all the time, not every day. I mean, there are times I'm on my knees praying. I'm still doing it. But I'm starting to feel something. So, Southern Prayer, I can only acknowledge His will for us and the power to carry that out. Okay, well, I pray for a whole lot of people, and I do ask for some things. I ask for Him to keep me sober, to keep me from thinking or taking a drink. And I used it for cigarettes, and I ask Him to keep me from thinking or taking a smoke. And I also ask Him to shelter my marriage, if that be Your will. Because I'll tell you, when I first got sober, my husband did not understand my delicate alcoholic feelings. I would have divorced him, except that I did not have a job at the time, and I'm not stupid. So I stayed with him, and over time, he has improved by leaps and bounds. I really like him a whole lot now. He is the cutest, sweetest, nicest guy in the whole wide world. I think Monday we'll celebrate 18 years of marriage. And before he retired, he missed me when he went on the boat. Yeah, and he was glad to come home to his wife. And I was not this, well, I don't know about you ladies, but I would put on this week's outfit. Did anybody else ever do that? I mean, I didn't mean for it to be this week's outfit, but it was a pair of gray sweatpants. The shirts would vary according to the season, t-shirt, sweatshirt, and I'd wear it for a week. I'd mean to bathe, but things would get in my way, like drinking. And so, this, and I, now if I'm working, I would bathe, but if I wasn't working, I'm just home stinking. And he did not find me sexually attractive then. Who knew? But that's the kind of wife I was, and it's not the kind of wife I'm now. I try to bathe 2-3 times a week now, whether I need it or not. This morning, this very morning I bathed, I have on clean underwear. Although we went on a cruise, so I bought new underwear for the cruise. I outgrew all of them. But I had packed old underwear from Minneapolis, so I have on underwear. As a matter of fact, you know, usually they have women wear dresses up here, which just creeps me out completely. So I'm completely naked from the waist down. Just thought I'd throw that out. Puts a picture up there, doesn't it? Anyway, now we're at step 12. Okay, how am I doing on time? I forgot to look. I already forget. Okay, remember you can leave whenever you want to. Okay, I'm going to hurry. Okay. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, and let me tell you, my spiritual awakening came as the result of the steps. We try to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Man, that practicing the principles is the hard part, isn't it? Staying awake for me from a drink's easy. I just don't pour it down my throat. Honesty, integrity, humility. You know, those are the toughies. Selflessness. But I try and I'm getting better. But my very, very, very favorite part of this program is carrying the message. As some of y'all may be able to tell, I'm not real shy. This is not, as a matter of fact, I chaired a meeting at 10 days sober. I didn't know there was a time limit. And the place I did, you're supposed to be 3 months sober, but I didn't know it. And someone asked me to. My third meeting was a speaker meeting. I was enthralled. I thought, well, you get the whole hour. I am not normal. So I waited till about, it was on a Saturday, so I waited till about Monday going, how do you get to be a speaker? And they said, you have to be sober 6 months. Nothing could have made me drink that first 6 months. Nothing. Couldn't wait to get up here. And then they said, someone has to ask you. Well, actually, at about 5 months and 2 weeks, they went ahead and stretched the rules and let me speak. And then I got asked to speak a lot. And I thought, of course, it was because I was so amazingly interested and good looking. What I didn't realize is this terrifies most people, and that if you have a car and you're willing to show up, they'll ask dogs to speak. They really don't care. It has nothing to do with the message. It just has to do with, are you really going to show up? And then I discovered there were circuit speakers. Well, I knew that's why God had gotten me sober, so I could be a circuit speaker. I have no ego. So I'm convinced I need to do this. By this time, I've met Larry and Denise, and she's on the committee, and she said, well, send me a tape. Well, I'd never been recorded, so I go to record the tape that's going to make me be a circuit speaker. I have never in my life given a worse lead in my whole life. 10 minutes, I'm out of things to say. I am, not, of course, some of y'all are thinking that right now, but thanks for sitting through it. Well, anyway, so it was terrible. For some reason, they did not ask me to become a circuit speaker. I gave up that dream, just like my dream to become a child star, the whole age thing. I wanted to be Darla from the Little Rascals or Shirley Temple. You know, I still do, but it's too late. But what I discovered was I'm really good at service work. I'm tenacious. My husband uses the term tick-like. Relentless. Responsible. I really liked the responsibility statement. You know, I am responsible. When anyone, anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. And I took that one very seriously. I became a corrections chair at my district level. Remember, I've never been arrested, never been to jail, never been pulled over. And let me tell you, you can get cleared real quick. They run my name through. Nothing happens. It's really good. And I found my niche. I love corrections work. It's the very best thing I ever do. I still do it. I was able to get meetings started back into our county jails. We had not had meetings in a long time for some reason. I got them going again. I found out that we had a women's prison opened up about an hour and a half drive away. And I tried to get women in that area to go, and for whatever reasons, I couldn't. And I got some women in my area, and we went up and we got cleared. And I got to be at the very first outside AA meeting going in this women's prison. And I got choked up. I made my sponsee pack go. I did not know she was still drinking. Luckily, they did not have a sobriety requirement. But shortly after that, she has stopped drinking, and she and I have been going. We've been going in. It'll be coming up on 5 years now. I make my sponsees do service work. They do not have a choice. They do corrections work. They're going to have to do it for at least 2 years. Then they can step back. But generally what I find after 2 years, they're hooked. Some of them still hate it. Some of them are still scared, but they still go in there. Pat is now sponsoring girls. Her girls have all been cleared to go into the prison. It's going to be one big happy family. I also got a meeting going into a federal prison clean across the state. I stood at the area level and got corrections chair, and one day I got this letter from an inmate in a federal prison in Beckley, said, please, can you get some outside AAs to come in? And I went through their DCM and any connections in that district, and for whatever reasons, no one in that district was willing to go. And let me tell you, the inmate services guys really didn't want us coming in, but tick-like. I kept calling and calling, and one day he wasn't there, and I spoke to someone else, and I learned there were two levels of volunteers, one that had to undergo a four-hour training, and the other one that had to have no training. They could only go in four times a year. They did not want women coming in, so I asked all the men I knew locally, would they be willing to go to Beckley four times a year? It's from an hour and a half to two-hour drive one way. I got several men who agreed. I've learned, do not give them the papers and expect to give them back. Give them the papers, make them sit down and fill it out, and you mail them in. It's a stamp phobia. It's rampant in Alcoholics Anonymous. Many, many, many people suffer from it. Don't ever waste time with self-addressed stamped envelopes. You know, you're only helping the post office. So I got a meeting going into a federal prison that was an hour and a half away from me. And every single man that went in said it was one of the best experiences they'd ever have. The men were very, very grateful. Well, I'm still going into the jails. As a matter of fact, I think the Thursday after I get back, I'll be going back into the jails. We carry a meeting into our, West Virginia is very progressive. We have regional jails. It covers five counties. All our jails are really old, and they weren't going to pass muster. They were going to have to shut them down, so they built new ones. We have them all over the state. So that's what I do. But what I'd like to close with, I know the magic words you've been waiting for, close, was while we were going into the women's prison, we carried a step study in. And, you know, a lot of those ladies are there to look good for parole. A lot of them are there to get out of their cells. And frankly, I tell you what, if I was in prison, you know, I would, you know, I don't care why they're there. Believe it or not, there are people on the outside sitting in AA meetings that are not there because they have a desire to stay sober. So I don't care why they're there. You know, I don't have a message of how I got in jail. I have a message of how I stay sober. I have a message of hope. You know, and that's all we need. So with Holly's permission, I will read some excerpts from letters that she wrote me. Holly was a little girl we saw in jail. I mean, in prison. I mean, I tell you what, when we went to that first meeting, okay, and I have to say West Virginia is not maybe a little bit like Minnesota. Y'all all pretty blonde up here. Okay, we're 79% white male in our prisons, and we have no gangs. So anyway, I'm looking out in this room full of women. I was the scariest looking person in the room, you know. I mean, these sweet little, a lot of them sweet little young things. So anyway, we carried the step study, and Holly got into it. She'd read in her big book and do her steps, and she showed up, I forget how many pages she had on, you know, for her resentments, and she was really into it. But, you know, it talks about in the big book where we watch people recover, and the change in her was palatable. You could see it coming over her. But we were not allowed to communicate with her as long as she was in jail, but she had broken probation, and after she got out of prison, she had to go down to a jail in Tennessee, and I was able to drop by and visit her once. But that's where she wrote me. So she wrote me some of these letters. I'm going to read you some excerpts with her permission. And then I'm going to read you a final letter of what it's like today for her. And then I'm going to sit down. Then you're going to, like, stand up but uproariously applaud. Because I have sensitive alcoholic feelings. Here we go. I want you to be encouraged because the work you do behind the walls is so important. I truly feel that God knows some people can't make it to AA on the streets. Lord knows I couldn't. If I hadn't gotten incarcerated, I may never have made it. But the first time I stepped into a meeting, even incarcerated, I knew I was home. I felt a hope that was missing before. At the end, when I said keep coming back, I felt like I said it more to the outside ladies, like keep coming back in to do the meetings. I want you to be encouraged, sharing your experience, strength, and hope with me. I can't tell you how much it means when you're locked up. It's hard to keep hope when you're in an environment where you see the same girls come in and out and in and out, even some that seem like they're working a program. It gets a little disheartening, like, can I do this? But seeing you guys really living and working the program is a breath of fresh air, and it gives me the hope I need, one day at a time. My higher power and the program have given me such a peace and serenity that even in a dirty, overcrowded, understaffed county jail, I am blessed. And so before I came up here, I told Holly I was coming up to Minnesota and that I often read those quotes from the letter, but I'd like to have a what it's like now for her. And so when you think you have nothing to offer, you don't have a serious criminal history, and you're bored with AA, try construction work. It's really a lot harder. Try corrections work. I'm looking around here, and I'm seeing a lot of men. Quite often, General Service often needs men to write to men in prison. They always have enough women. They need men writing men. They don't care about your spelling. They don't care about your grammar. They don't care about your English. They need a contact. Many of our prisons have absolutely no outside AAs coming in. And I don't care if you don't like to write. Do it anyway. You'll get more out of it than you can ever imagine. You may touch someone's life. You may plant that seed that they need. And some of them may never get out, but you can give them hope. So here is what Holly's doing today. Okay, now on to me. Let's see where to start. Dear Lord, my life is so blessed. Kathy, when I was out there, I lived in tents, hotels, in parks, in vans. All my possessions were carried on my back. Stevie, that's her husband. And I constantly fought we're never going to get married. Our dogs usually ate people food because carrying dog food was too much. We were complete vagabonds, hopping from concert to festival to concert, selling drugs and staying drunk and high. I never held a real job for very long. I never called my family. My mother was on nerve pills to deal with the pain of losing me. My mom would later tell me that she would come home every day to listen to the answer machine in hopes that there would be a message for me so she would know if I were alive or dead. She was so happy when I was in prison or jail because at least she knew where I was and felt I was somewhat safe. Then she didn't have to worry that I would be some unidentified body found dead in a ditch. Today, Kathy, I can barely believe what a far cry from that my life is. Stevie and I have a wonderful relationship, happily married, and even vows renewed. It isn't always perfect, but we try to keep God at the center, and the real sober love is now there to get us through. As far as physical stuff, we have a house we're renting, possibly to own. We have two cars, and our needs are always met. Not always our wants, but always our needs. We just got a new dog, a rescue. She is a 3-year-old black lab and is beautiful and such a lover dog, and she has tons of foods and treats in the cupboard. I have wonderful relationships with my nieces and nephews' lives. They no longer have to ask, when is Aunt Holly getting out of jail? I have been at my job as a clerical biller for almost 2 years now and have gotten 2 promotions since I have been here. God allows me to take a meeting into the local mental institute every Tuesday, and the patients are so appreciative to hear the message of recovery. God also allows me to go into one of the local jails 1 or 2 times a month. I sponsor 3 women who are such a blessing in my life, as my sponsor is a blessing in mine. I have 2 service positions at the home group level, and I'm currently working the steps for the 4th time. My husband and I have found an awesome church. We are even youth group leaders for ages 13 through 18 in our church, and God gives us patience to deal with the teens. We think of ourselves as danger signs that try to point kids away from the path we went down. Whatever way He can use our crazy past for the greater good is such a blessing. Kathy, most of all, I have peace. I have serenity. I can face life on life's terms today, and I have a relationship with the Creator of the universe. He dwells in my heart and has redeemed my soul, and He gently guides my path if I stay still and quiet enough to hear Him. Kathy, I really feel that this life is not mine anymore. If I had paid the consequences of my actions and decisions, I would be dead 10 times over. God in His great grace pulled me through so much. So I am on borrowed time, and that time is God's time. So I try to the best of my ability to turn my will and my life over to Him all day, every day. I try to be His vessel and do the smallest steps I take to do the work He wants me to do. And I get it wrong 1,000,000 times a day. But I continue to stumble toward the light. And for the smallest steps I take in the right direction, God meets me there and blesses me and walks me through. It is a beautiful life. One I don't always feel like I deserve. I never knew life could be so simple and so good. So that's where I am today, amazed at His amazing grace and this blessing of life. Thank you.